And welcome to Innovation on Dakota Midday. I'm Kara Hetland, and we're broadcasting from the studios at the University of Sioux Falls. And my first guest today is Jim Vogelman. He's the research ecologist for the USGS Eros Center. Jim, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
This week marks the 15th anniversary of the Landsat 7 satellite and the first anniversary of images coming from Landsat 8. So we thought we'd spend a little time talking about the technology and talking about some of its applications. So let's begin. First images a year ago. You were there?
I was there.
Yes.
And actually, I was there for the launch for Landsat 7 as well.
Okay.
And I'll say this much. I've seen a lot of rocket launches on television. It's really neat to be able to see them in person.
Okay. So you weren't there for the launch of 8, though?
I was there for 8 as well as
in person?
Seven. Yep.
At the launch site or watching it on?
No, on the at the launch
at
site.
At the pad.
Yeah, at Vandenberg Air Force Base.
Okay. Very cool. So you were, so tell me what that was like.
Well, basically, you're quite a ways away from the rocket. Mm-hmm. For safety reasons, they don't want to have you too close to it. But the bottom line is there's a lot of buildup, you know, and the countdowns and all that, and there's a crowd that's watching. And the moment that it starts going up and you get all the, you know, the vapor and the smoke and whatnot, it's really awe-inspiring. And you get, there's these very low vibrations, almost sort of sensor sound sort of feelings that you get, even though it's a long ways away. And then you just basically watch this rocket slowly lift off and head off into space. And you know that there's a lot of work and, get to that point. And you're basically just sort of relieved to watch the thing launch successfully.
Right. Now, you did you help design Landsat 7?
I'm a scientist. And so what we do is we're there for advice and consultation. We let the actual designing up to the engineers of the satellite.
Okay.
We will provide advice. There's a lot of things that come up in a year's time where there are questions on how to do this or how to do that. And the scientific community and the members who are actually part of the science team for these various sensors will weigh in and give their their best judgment as to maybe how to proceed.
Mm-hmm. So you get to be the one to say, here's what I wanted to do.
You can say that. you may not get it.
Okay, but I'm just wondering the process, the difference between the designing of Landsat 7 and then the input you were able to have for the design of Landsat 8.
Yeah, well, I mean, the bottom line is that, I'm going to go back to Landsat 1, if I may.
Yeah.
Landsat 1 was launched in 1972.
Okay.
And then there was a follow-on Landsat after several years after that. Which was a little bit like a clone of Landsat 1, but that was a very experimental beast at that point. Nobody had an idea, or much of an idea, as to what the sensor technology would be able to do for us back in that era. And it was very successful, and so, the next step was, let's launch a Landsat 3, but let's improve things. And they added a thermal capability. And so Landsat 3 was launched, had this thermal capability, people liked it. And then they started saying, we can improve how the various sensor technology works. You know, when you think about it, Landsat 1 was 1960s technology, essentially.
Did you have to, catch the film on an aircraft?
No, it wasn't. I mean, it was all digital. It was beamed down digitally.
Okay.
But the bottom line is that it was old technology, and so by the time you get into the 1980s, technology's improved a lot, and so you can start improving the satellite technology quite a bit. And they did that. So I guess what I'm getting at is that with each satellite that gets launched, there are improvements that are made. And so Landsat 7 had improvements over the previous Landsat, which was essentially 5, since Landsat 6 did not achieve orbit, but the improvements were improved calibration, so the data were better than ever before. And the other main thing was that we started developing what we called a long-term acquisition plan, It was a strategy to acquire imagery for the entire globe, not just, you know, not just the United States or not just Europe, but the entire land surface. And so Landsat 7 was the first time that we actually had this strategy to acquire imagery for everywhere. And that's mm-hmm. a big deal. That's a big deal.
Right.
And then of course, is Landsat 8. And with the case of Landsat 8, same type of strategy, lots of global, the idea is to get global data sets. But now what we're doing is we've really improved the imagery. So, you know, well, like I said, each time you launch right. a satellite, you improve things.
Okay, so can you take the images from Landsat 8 and compare them to Landsat 1? Or is that more comparing apples to oranges?
It's a little apples and oranges, but we do it. You know, this continuity of observations means that you can go back to 1972 and start looking at, you know, the land surface as it was back then. And you know, humans sort of, their memories are such that, you know, they sort of forget things.
Mm-hmm.
And what Landsat does is it provides objectivity. So you can go back to 1972. Even though you thought it looked like this, Landsat says it really did look like this. And so it gives us objective measurements going back to 72. We do the comparisons. When we go back to the very early satellite sensors and, you know, what we would consider sort of primitive technology now, we do have to, you know, do the interpretations with, you know, we have to be a little bit careful on how we do it. But we can still use it, and we still do use it for giving us a long-term observations and insight as to how things are changing.
And when you're in, and you're talking more of landscapes, land changes in forests and changes in water use?
Sort of all of the above. We do tend to work at the landscape level. It's not the sort of technology that's going to allow you to read a license plate of a car or something like that.
Right, you can't tell me what color a shirt I'm wearing?
Nope.
Okay.
But what it can do, it's very good for natural resource applications. And so if we want to have a general overview as to how the crops are doing, how the soybeans are doing, or how the corn is doing, we can do that with this particular sensor technology. So it's very good at detecting things that are of interest to the agricultural community. It's very appropriate for people in the forestry community. Where are the forest fires? What are the species of trees that we're dealing with? Where is the logging occurring? Where is deforestation is occurring? It's very good at that. People in the disaster arena will use the data when they can use it, when they can get a hold of it for, you know, how big is the flood? What areas are impacted? Mm-hmm. Where did the fire occur? It's really got multiple applications. The people who are along the seacoasts, they might use it for urbanization studies because that's where human density is rather, mm-hmm. you know, it's rather high there. Or they might want to look at the areas which are, you know, right off the coast. You know, where are the algal blooms or where are particular pollution events occurring? So, bottom line is it's mm-hmm. got a lot of applications. A lot of people can find use that's useful for them.
Okay, and I have to ask because I know that you're not a part of this, but it's also used perhaps in searching for an airplane in the last month or so.
Certainly, all of this remotely sensed technology can be used for looking for things like debris in oceans and so forth. You know, and
it's a big ocean.
It's a huge ocean, and you know, there's no question that the technology is there to do some interesting things with this along those lines. But you have to know where to look, mm-hmm. and a lot of times people assume that the technology exists for looking everywhere, and you know, you see this on TV shows and whatnot.
Right.
We're not there. We have to know where to look. And if we have some clues, then we will do that and maybe find some things that are of use to people.
Okay. But again, that's not your department. You're not the emergency responder group.
I'm not. We do have a group that does some of that at Eros. A lot of what you see from them, they'll be mostly interested in, anything, any disaster that comes up. But floods and fires tend to be the big things mm-hmm. that crop up all the time.
Right, and the tsunami was big.
The tsunami was certainly a big one. Hurricanes. Right. And that's also the scale for which Landsat is appropriate for.
Right. And again, you talk about the scale because you can't just zoom in and identify a person because it's, the pixel is what? The size of a football field?
Yeah, it's 30 meters on a side. So, it's great for looking at agricultural fields because you get a whole bunch of pixels in a given agricultural
right.
field. But if you really want to know, what's going on in your parking lot, you can't really do that so well with this particular technology. There are other sensors that will allow you to do that maybe, or at least that approach that resolution. That's not really where Landsat's forte is. We really are looking at landscape level. Can we put things into proper context, sort of mm-hmm. a way of doing things?
And so your job then is looking at these images and making comparisons and then doing what with it?
Well, a lot of what we do is looking for change. In my case, I'm supported by a couple projects. One project that I work on is related to fire. A lot of this is wildland fire, and so we're interested in where the fires are occurring and how severe they are. We're also interested in the condition of the vegetation where these fires burn. And the more of this information you know, the more you can predict where fires are going to spread in the future. So that's one of my roles at Eros, is we actually use the satellite technology with the goals in mind and ultimately being used for predicting wildland fire behavior. So that's just one example.
After it starts or before it even starts?
A little bit of both.
Okay.
If you know the condition of the forest, and if you know that it's a very dense forest and it's very, maybe there's been an insect outbreak in it
right.
and it's maybe not too healthy and there's a lot of dead materials in that.
And you can tell that from a satellite image.
You can tell that from a satellite image.
Huh.
If you know what that condition of the forest is like, and you know the weather conditions, and you know a few mm-hmm. other things which come from other sources of information, you can start making reasonably good stabs at how the fire is going to spread through the forest. If it starts at a particular point. You
right.
can't predict that it's going
right.
to start
right.
here, but once it starts, you can predict.
But can you also look at images now and say, okay, this is going to be an area to keep an eye on this summer?
You can look at the image, yes. The bottom line is that's within the scope of what we try to do with some of these fire projects. Now, the other side is that once they have burned, it's important to know where they've burned because that gives us indications as to what type of vegetation there will be to burn maybe 2 years from now or four right. years from now. So knowing where the previous fire has occurred gives us a lot of information as well, which is equally important.
So you're coming into your busy season. Or is it year round?
it's certainly coming into the busy season. July, August, and September seem to be the really, really busy months, but they seem to be getting a little bit earlier over the last few years.
Okay, and later on in the program, we're going to hear a conversation about taking action about climate change, and is that data that Eros provides?
We're not so much in the business of climate change. We will look at the data and use it for what we can, for what it seems to be appropriate for. Now, there are a lot of times we'll look at the information and say, gosh, that sure looks like, something that might be related to a climate variable. And we will pull in the climate information and start doing some analyses. But mostly what we do is we provide information for people. But we're not really climate change scientists per se.
Mm-hmm. So now, a few years ago, Eros decided to give all of its images away for free, correct?
That's correct.
And so how has your your job changed now that more scientists are able to get their hands on these images and do the same work that you're doing?
Great question. And I'm going to go back a little bit in time. I came from New Hampshire. I'd been at the University of New Hampshire for about 7 years before coming out here. And we had a project that was to, and you know, you all know that New Hampshire's not a very big state.
Okay.
It's itty bitty. At that time, we were paying full price for data, and we were basically charged with the task of generating a wetlands map for the state of New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. Fairly straightforward sort of a task. And New Hampshire is a very frugal state, a little bit like South Dakota in some regards. And we had to buy the data, and the data cost $35,000. That's a lot of money for a little state, and for the state of state of New Hampshire to cough that money up was a major deal for them. Mm-hmm. Okay, so flash forward to now, where you're actually dealing with things at a global scale, and you can't even imagine paying that amount of money for these data sets. So the bottom line is, we can do a lot of things now that we couldn't even conceive of 20 years ago because of the free data. So it allows us to look at larger areas. It allows us to start using the entire archive. You know, before we'd sort of say, okay, let's get a scene, maybe cover this particular area from this year, and oh gosh, maybe we'll get one from another year, 10 years ago, and do the analysis and do a some sort of a change assessment with those two scenes. Well, that's okay. You can get some good information from that. But now we can use all of the archive because it's free. And so what we start doing is doing these sorts of comparisons with 1972 mm-hmm. data and 1974 and 1983 and 2010, put it all into these files and do the change analyses, and we get lots more interesting information that we've never been able to see before.
Okay. At no additional cost.
Well,
right.
Well,
I mean, you get to anyway because you work there,
no,
right?
No, actually, we've always had to pay for the data. Yeah,
your department?
Our department. We've never had any special privileges when it comes to data costs.
Oh, so now
So now we actually, this has been a real boon to the field. We have people who are innovating, like your show, innovating all across the country and using these data sets to, you know, look at their specific problems. And like I said, the information that you get from looking at the entire archive is so much greater than what we've been able to do before. It gives us much more insight as to the type of changes that are taking place across the Earth's landscape.
And then if others are able to do it too, then you have confirmation, you have justification.
We have all of the above. There's only so much time in a year. We can't do everything. We have particular missions that we're in charge of and particular projects that we lead. But that's only part of the story. So when the academics or other departments from other agencies decide to do these sorts of analyses, that's great. It's just so long as we're not duplicating efforts.
Mm-hmm. And then, okay, so you helped throw your ideas in for the design of 7 and the design of Landsat 8. Is there already talk for, here's what I'd like to see the next one to do?
Absolutely. We're just starting those talks in a reasonably formal manner right now. We're always looking into the future. The sensors that are designed their design life is 5 years, and we like to get them to have last a lot longer, and usually they do. But from an engineering standpoint, we can't plan on much more than 5 years out of these sensors. We hope for more, but it doesn't always happen. Right now, and it also takes about 5 years from start to finish to design one of these. So we, you know, when one is launched, you have to start right up and start designing the next mm-hmm. one. And so, yes, we've been in discussion with various groups and to do just that. What should Landsat 9 look like?
Mm-hmm. And what do you want to see?
Well, what I want to see, well, you know, not to get sort of piggy about things.
You're the one talking, so you get to say.
But, you know, when you work with the data for years and years, you start seeing some of their weaknesses. You certainly mm-hmm. see some of their strengths.
Uh-huh.
One of the weaknesses is that, you know, we deal with data sets for any given sensor acquired every 16 days. And so if you've got two sensors going around the Earth, you know, we're talking about 8-day repeat coverage. A lot of things that happen of interest happen maybe on the day that the overpass didn't occur, or maybe it was cloudy. And so what a lot of us on the science team would like to see are more and more data sets, which would probably require more satellites. But if we could bring that down from every 8-day coverage to maybe every 4 days, or even better, I think we'd be able to, once again, tell a better story.